Welcome to The Wildlife, a program that probes the mysteries of the animal world through interviews with scientists and other wildlife investigators. I'm Laurel Nemi, your host for The Wildlife, and also author of Animal Investigators, How the World's First Wildlife Forensic Lab is Solving Crimes and Saving Endangered Species. Today on The Wildlife, I'll talk with U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service Special Agent Sheila O'Connor in the first of a two-part interview. Today we'll focus on her adventures in wildlife law enforcement. In the second part, we'll concentrate on what it takes to be an agent and the specialized training that these officers go through. Have you ever wondered what it's like to be a Fish and Wildlife Service special agent? Special Agent O'Connor is a veteran wildlife law enforcement officer with 20 years of service under her belt. She began her career in wildlife law enforcement as a conservation police officer for the Illinois Department of Natural Resources, where she served for 8 years. She then moved to federal wildlife law enforcement with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, where she's been a special agent for over 12 years. As a federal Fish and Wildlife Service special agent, she was first posted to Ann Arbor, Michigan, and then moved to St. Paul, Minnesota, where she spent 8 years. During that time, she investigated several cases that led to felony convictions for violations of wildlife laws, including some cases we'll talk about today. She was recently promoted to be a training officer at the Federal Law Enforcement Training Center, also known as FLETC, located in Georgia. When we spoke, I began by asking Special Agent O'Connor how she first got interested in wildlife law enforcement.
It was one of those family vacations as a kid. I grew up in the Midwest and in a large family that didn't do outdoor stuff unless, you know, kick the can is outdoor stuff. And we went on a vacation to the Smoky Mountains, and I had never been to the mountains before, and I just thought it was fantastic, and it was very scenic and beautiful, and I saw the park rangers, and I thought, wow, they get to stand there and look at this view all day, and of course, that's not really what they do. That's just what they do in the mind of an eight-year-old, and I thought to myself, someday I want to have a job like that, and that's what first started it for me. And I've always loved animals. I was always, you know, begging my parents to get a pet and, you know, fish, you know, goldfish at the fair and stuff, you know. So it started early for me with a love of animals and then wildlife and then natural areas.
And how did you learn that this career even existed in terms of law enforcement?
Well, I was working at the Sears Tower, and I had a friend who was a state trooper, and he said, I was telling him what I wanted to do, and he said that there were conservation officers. This is, again, in the state of Illinois. I grew up in the Midwest, and I asked him, I said, the next time you see one of the conservation officers, can you pick up an application for me? And he said, sure, and a few months later, he saw one, got the application packet. I filled it out, was hired on in 1990 and became a conservation police officer for the state of Illinois. It's something that I had always thought about off and on during my life. And when I got to college, I actually thought I might go on to law school and study environmental law. I was not really aware of the opportunities on the front lines of law enforcement, of wildlife law enforcement, until later. And so I became a conservation police officer for the state of Illinois. I worked there for 8 years, and then I joined the Fish and Wildlife Service, and I've been here for 12.
As a state officer, what kind of work were you doing, and how did it differ from the federal? So you started working at the Illinois Department of Natural Resources as a conservation officer. So what kind of work did you do for the state agency?
Well, it's a lot like a patrol officer versus a detective. As a state conservation officer, you wear a uniform every day. You're in a marked patrol unit. I went out on boat patrols on Lake Michigan in the summertime, state park patrols. I checked fishermen and hunters for compliance, did boat safety inspections, did some training, some teaching at boat safety and hunter safety and snowmobile safety classes for the public and that sort of thing. And so as a conservation officer, as more of the frontline equivalent of a patrol officer, And now with the Fish and Wildlife Service, we do much more investigations. It's not so much, hi, how are you doing today? I need to check your fishing license. I don't really do that anymore. Now, as a special agent, we handle complaints, criminal complaints, things like smuggling of wildlife, things like illegal commercialization, things that a uniformed patrol officer is not terribly well equipped to handle. You know, it's more investigative in nature than first response would be. A conservation officer would be more first response.
What prompted you to move into the federal system to get to be that detective as opposed to the patrol officer?
Well, I loved my job as a conservation officer. I absolutely loved it. It was a lot of fun. It was very meaningful work. It was just, you know, I had a great group of coworkers. And but I started seeing that I wanted to work on cases that could have a greater impact on the resource, on actually saving a resource. As a uniformed officer, you're limited in what you can work on. I mean, I couldn't work on cases in other states, for example. We might have resources that were being taken illegally in one state and being brought back to the state of Illinois. That's not something that I was able to work on. And bigger than that, there are resources all over the world that need protection that end up going into or through or from the United States all over the world. And I wanted the opportunity. I made the leap to Fish and Wildlife Service because I wanted the opportunity to work on cases that would have a larger impact on resource protection. And it's not that the job of a uniformed conservation officer is unimportant. It's very important. As a conservation officer, you focus on saving the resources of the state that you live in and the public safety of the people that are using those resources. And that's very important. And I don't want to minimize that. I wanted the opportunity to work on larger cases that had a larger scope. And that's why I made the leap to Fish and Wildlife.
Now, one of the cases that I've read about that I think you worked on as a when you were at the state agency, and this was in 1993, when you found a Mexican red-kneed tarantula for sale
right
at a pet store. Can you tell me about that?
Yeah, I actually didn't have a very big role in that case. I just found the tarantula at a pet shop and then turned it over to the feds. But in 1993, I had received a complaint of illegal reptile commercialization. Also, we sometimes call it herptile because it's not just reptiles. It's all different sorts of herps. It's salamanders and amphibians, and tarantulas are part of the reptile trade. Even though they're not reptiles, they are very popular among reptile enthusiasts.
Oh, really? Why is that?
I don't know.
That's interesting.
I don't know. They're unusual pets. They're alternative pets, and they're perhaps a bit harder to find. It's not all that easy to find a pet snake at a pet shop. It has become much more mainstream than it was in 1993, for example. But you know, there are people who do nothing but collect pet snakes. That's their hobby, and they spend a lot of money on it, and they're very dedicated to it. And the same with tarantulas. There are people that do nothing but tarantulas and that sort of thing. So as part of this complaint on illegal reptile commercialization, I was still working for the state, and I started going into area pet shops in my patrol area. I did not go in uniform. I just went in plain clothes to look around and see which pet shops might be selling what different items. The state of Illinois, and as do most states, regulate the sale of native commercial wildlife, of native wildlife on a commercial basis, I should say, and whether that wildlife is bred in captivity or whether it is not, the states will tend to regulate that, usually through the issuance of permits and filing of annual reports and periodic inspections and that sort of thing. So I was just sort of in an intel gathering phase, seeing what was going on in my area. This is an area that I hadn't really looked at closely before this complaint came in. And I went to a pet shop that was in my patrol area, and I saw this tarantula in a case, in an aquarium case. And there was a sign on the case that said, first one out of Mexico in 3 years, prohibited by Mexican government, or words to that effect. And
what did this tarantula look like? How big was it?
It was, well, let's see. Tarantulas are pretty big spiders. It was the size approximately of the palm of my hand, so maybe somewhere between about four inches in length, and they're sort of, you know, circular, so they're about the same all the way around. And it was black. It was all hairy, and it was black, but its knees, they're not really knees, the joints on some of its legs had red hair, hence the name red-kneed tarantulas. And I looked around the pet shop and saw some other things that were of concern to the state. Tarantulas, of course, are not native to the state of Illinois. And so I went back to my office and I looked them up on the endangered species list to see if they were listed. The state of Illinois protects not only native wildlife, but also anything that's on the federal endangered or threatened species list. Well, they weren't there either. But I knew that a violation had occurred. It said so right on the case. First one out of Mexico in 3 years. That means that it was smuggled across the border into the United States from Mexico. And so I called the Fish and Wildlife Office in the Chicago area. I had worked with agents there a couple of times before and reported it to them. One of them took up the case and, make a long story short, ended up finding the supplier of these tarantulas and several other live tarantulas as well. And their felony charges were filed against several parties, and they were convicted in court. I don't recall specifically what happened to the pet shop, what penalty they paid. They clearly knew that the tarantula was illegal, and they were prosecuted. I just don't remember what happened with them. But one of the tarantulas, you know, whenever we can, we keep animals. We need to keep them for evidence. Well, if they're live, we do our very best to keep them live. And the agent who was working the case had the ability to care for one of the live tarantulas. And the rest were placed with other experts in the industry. You know, we have to preserve them for evidence. This is our evidence for court. We can't show up at court with no evidence of a crime. And the one that the agent kept, he named Elvira. But we don't really know if it was male or female. So,
how do you tell if a tarantula is male or female?
Your guess is as good as mine. I'm sure that there are people out there who know that sort of thing, but I do not know the answer to that.
So the one he kept was, he named Elvira, and she became a spoke spider. Is that right?
She did. He would bring her to, the agent would bring Elvira to educational talks, you know, like with school groups and that sort of thing, to educate people on the live pet trade, how not all of it is legal. It's not just because you see something for sale in a pet shop doesn't mean it's legal for you to buy it. Doesn't mean it entered the pet shop or the pet trade legally. And it's cool. I mean, what fifth grade boy doesn't want to see a tarantula in class? I mean, you know, it's an attention getter, that's for sure.
And then was the tarantula ever released, or do you know if the tarantula just stayed a spoke spider?
The tarantula stayed a spoke tarantula. the problem with live wildlife is when it's been kept in captivity and we don't really know the history of where it was collected from. You know, we knew it came out of Mexico, and we had a general idea of what area of Mexico it came out of. But once it's been subjected to captive conditions, a lot of animals are really not releasable back to the wild. They can pick up all sorts of diseases in captivity that, if they were released to the wild, then they would spread to their wild counterparts, and you could wipe out a local population, a regional population, or in some cases, an entire population of an animal. The other thing, too, is biologists will tell you that unless you know the exact population that an animal came from, it's really not a very good idea to release it back to just a general population, because there are gene pools of you know, the same snake or turtle can develop different genes if it comes from one side of Lake Erie versus the other side of Lake Erie. They're genetically distinct. They can become genetically distinct populations. And so then just introducing one that came from Lake Erie. Well, what part of Lake Erie? Maybe there are several different populations. So you mix gene pools like that, and it sounds like a great idea. Oh, let's release this back to the wild and let it live its natural life. That sounds like a great thing, and that is our goal when we have enough information to do that. But it's rarely possible to do that, frankly.
And so when something enters the pet trade illegally, even if it's alive, it's affecting, you know, even if it's confiscated and saved, it's actually affecting a lot because it can't go back into its population.
Right. That is one that will not contribute to the breeding of new tarantulas or leopards or parrots. I mean, they won't go back to the wild to live a natural life, so the animal itself is deprived of living its natural life. But it also, yes, you rob the population of different genes. Who knows what that individual could have contributed?
Does a tarantula make a good pet, or some of these other exotic creatures?
Wild animals seldom make good pets. They are, number one, they're not happy in captivity, and so they will be under individual stress. Domestic animals, the difference between a wild animal as a pet and a domestic animal like a dog or a cat as a pet is that they have developed, domestic animals have developed a need for humans. Dogs and cats depend on their human owners to take care of them. Their lives in the wild, if they were to be released from ownership and just dumped in a forest preserve somewhere or a park somewhere, their lifespan is very short. They need us to survive, and we have developed an emotional attachment to them. With wild animals, that's not the case. They don't need us to survive. So number one, when you take an individual, let's say a tarantula, out of the wild and put it in a captive situation, it's not going to be living its natural life. I don't want to assign emotions to tarantulas. I know very little about tarantulas. You can tell when a dog is happy or not happy, but I don't know if you can tell when a tarantula is happy or not happy. But that animal is going to be under stress. It is deprived of living its natural life. So that's, you know, area number one. Number two, wild animals have unpredictable behavior. Even domestic animals can have unpredictable behavior. But, you know, we've come to learn the breed traits of, you know, golden retrievers and Himalayan cats and that sort of thing because they've been domesticated for such a long time. But how do you domesticate a lion? How do you domesticate a bear? Those animals are unpredictable. Their behavior is unpredictable. They're huge. And it's particularly dangerous when the animals are predators, like big cats and bears. Tarantulas are not human predators. But that doesn't mean that they would necessarily make a good pet. And then their behavior is still unpredictable.
In the U.S., I know there are, I've heard figures of 10,000 to 15,000 pet tigers. Although why you'd want a pet tiger, I'm not quite sure, but because they grow.
Right. I think part of the problem is that we don't have a really good number on how many pet tigers are being kept. I would clarify to say in non-accredited zoo facilities, there are people who have pet tigers in their backyards, and I don't think we have a good number on how many people have those or how many tigers are living in those situations. We know how many tigers are in AZA accredited zoos, for example.
That's the Association of Zoos and Aquariums, which is a nonprofit organization that accredits zoos and aquariums to ensure that they've met rigorous standards.
And AZA accredited zoos will keep records on that tiger's ancestors all the way back to where that tiger, where its ancestors came out of the wild. And who its ancestors have been bred with so that there isn't any inbreeding going on. And if you talk to people who work at zoos, those animals are not safe to be around, even though they may have been bred in captivity for the last 7 or 8 generations. They're still tigers. You know, they're still big predators. So why you would want, I mean, I understand the attraction of certain animals. Tigers are very charismatic. They're interesting creatures. They're beautiful. I understand why people like them. I don't understand why people would want to have a pet tiger or a pet bear. It's dangerous, and it's not good for the animal.
Now, as a federal wildlife law enforcement agent, the pet trade, I know, is big. But before we talk about some of that or some cases related to that, I'm wondering if you could describe what a Fish and Wildlife Service special agent does.
Sure. As a Fish and Wildlife agent, we are charged with enforcing the nation's laws that protect our natural resources and animals, wildlife. And that includes things like the Endangered Species Act, which actually covers plants as well. Endangered and threatened species, there are certain things you can't do with them. You can't hunt them, for example, the way that you can hunt ducks when they're in season. You can't buy and sell them. You can't import and export them without special permits. And even then, it's pretty tough. So we would enforce things like the Endangered Species Act. And we protect wildlife all over the world through the Endangered Species Act. And going along with the Endangered Species Act is an international treaty nicknamed CITES. It's the Convention on the International Trade in Endangered Species of Wild Fauna and Flora. And again, these are species that have been identified all over the world as being at risk on one level or another through illegal trade, through illegal harvest. And so the United States is a signatory to that treaty. And so we would protect things like African elephants, Asian elephants, primates. Every primate is protected, no matter where they're located in the world, is protected under this treaty. All crocodilians, things like alligators, crocodiles, and caimans, all crocodilians are protected under this treaty, no matter where they're at in the world. So we would enforce those laws. We would enforce the Lacey Act, which basically means if you commit a wildlife crime in one state and then transport the fruits of that crime to another state, it becomes a federal offense. So if you go deer hunting illegally in New Hampshire and you poach a deer in New Hampshire and then you bring it back across state lines into Vermont, it's now a federal crime. It's no longer just a state crime. This is one way that we regulate animals that are not normally protected under federal law, is that if you cross state lines, it becomes a federal law. And then there's the Migratory Bird Treaty Act. We enforce that. That regulates things like duck hunting, goose hunting, the illegal take of birds, songbirds, for example. You can't hunt songbirds. Well, that's set out in the Migratory Bird Treaty Act, the importation and exportation of migratory birds. We own a lot of properties called National Wildlife Refuges, and there are laws set up to protect those areas as well. You can fish and boat in some areas and hunt in some areas, and you can't in others. So we would enforce that. A couple of the less known laws that we enforce deal with Native American artifacts, the Archaeological Resource Protection Act. We enforce that, and basically if you collect Native American artifacts off of federal property, it's a federal crime, and we can investigate that. And it does have an impact on our resources because those are dug out of, a lot of times, they're dug off of federal property. Let's see, what else? The Wild Bird Conservation Act, which is an act that's set up specifically to target the protection of birds coming into the United States from other countries. The Rhino Tiger Act, which is aimed at protecting rhinoceros and tigers from illegal commercialization, mostly in things like the medicinal trade.
The Rhino and Tiger Act, Conservation Act, that's unusual because you don't have to prove that a product actually contains rhinoceros or tiger for it to be an offense. Is that right?
Right. It just has to be labeled as containing it or advertised as containing it. So if the labeling on the package, for instance, says it claims to contain rhino horn, then it's a violation. And that may not make sense to some people, but I'll explain why that law exists. There is a big demand for medicinals that contain different kinds of wildlife, including rhino and tiger. And people will buy those products if they think that rhino and tiger are in those products. That said, that leads to the killing of rhinos and tigers to supply the medicinal trade. So even if the box that you're buying off a shelf doesn't actually contain rhino, it creates a demand for it. So somewhere out there in countries where rhinos still exist, people are trying to poach, kill rhinos illegally to sell their parts. So the Rhino Tiger Act is an attempt to specifically shut down the trade or the advertised trade in rhinos and tigers to give them extra protection because they are so critically endangered right now. They're disappearing. They're disappearing very quickly. They don't live in the United States in the wild. They live in foreign countries in the wild. We have no control over how well other countries enforce their wildlife and customs laws. And there's big, big money in this. That's why people do it.
So what kind of money are we talking about, say, for rhino horn or tiger bone?
Well, it mostly goes by weight, and it can also sometimes go by where the animal, what country it comes from. And I'm not an expert on Asian medicinals, but generally rhino horns are very, very valuable. I weighed one that we had in the office. I weighed it. It weighed about 4 pounds. And that
so this is just
to,
one horn that you weighed.
Right.
And it
right.
was about how and big, like the size of your
It weighed horn. About, well, it was probably right around 12 inches tall from the base to the tip. Okay. And that was worth about $100,000.
Wow.
Yeah. So it was about 4 pounds. So, and I don't have those figures in front of me right now, but if you think that roughly $25,000 a pound for rhino horn. Other parts of rhinos are utilized, the bones, the skin, the toenails. I'm not sure what the value is on that, but in some cultures they believe that rhino can cure cancer, rhino medicine can cure cancer. Tigers have two markets. There's a dead tiger market and there's a live tiger market. And sadly, dollar-wise, not environmentally, but dollar-wise, tigers are more valuable dead than they are alive because they can be sold in parts and pieces. And, you know, the hide itself has a value for things like trophies. People want to hang tiger skin rugs on their walls. So there's a trophy value for the skin. Then the bones have a value, the whiskers have a value, the claws have a value, the organs have a value. And when you disassemble a tiger, when you kill a tiger and sell it off by parts, you can make more money than if you were to sell one live as a pet, for example. Both are illegal, by the way. But a live tiger might only sell for something like $5,000 to $8,000, depending on its color. White tigers, live white tigers will easily sell for $50,000 on the black market. A dead tiger, though, just a regular old, nothing special tiger, figures that I have are more than 10 years old, and they're $70,000 to $100,000.
Wow.
There was a skeleton, there was a tiger skeleton that sold for $100,000 about, I think it was like 25 years ago.
And that's when there were more of them around, so presumably the price has gone up.
Not many more. Not many more. Tigers were endangered even back then when this one sold. It was a black market sale, of course. And when there is no more of something, then the remaining individuals become more valuable. I mean, that's just supply and demand. But that tigers and rhinos have been poached to the brink of extinction. And that's why the Rhino-Tiger Act exists in the way that it does, where we don't actually have to prove that it contains rhino or tiger. We just have to prove that someone claimed it did or that it's labeled as containing that, because that trade in and of itself is so harmful, so detrimental to the survival of the species overall, that it's a big deal. It's a big deal, and the law reflects that.
Are there any other species where that requirement that you don't have to prove that it actually is rhino horn?
Anything listed on CITES. CITES is written in the CITES treaty that we talked about earlier, the international treaty, is written in the same way to allow for that. That if it is labeled as containing or claims to contain a CITES protected species, then it's to be regulated in that way. So, again, this is something that's relatively new for the Fish and Wildlife Service, and we, I believe, are still in the process of changing our regulations to reflect that. But that is true, that anything protected by CITES can be handled in the same way, where the claim or the labeling that it contains a CITES-listed species is good enough for a criminal investigation.
Wow, that's interesting.
It is, and that's largely untested in the U.S. courts. I'm not sure if any cases have actually come before the court, before the United States court, that are based on a claim. Obviously, it's a much stronger case if we can prove that it actually does contain pangolin scales or whatever the label suggests. On the other hand, it's a reflection that so much wildlife is threatened by illegal commercialization all over the world, that it's reflected in this treaty.
Can you talk about some of your most interesting cases? You know, what kind of cases have come before you as an agent working in the Midwest at the federal level?
Let's see. Well, we talked a little bit about the live tiger trade. I did have a case involving the illegal sale of live endangered species. It's a husband and wife team that lived in Minnesota. I was stationed in St. Paul at the time, and they were buying and selling live animals. Some were not endangered, but many were, and they had an ocelot, they were buying and selling leopards, tigers, grizzly bears. That might have been it for the endangered and threatened species.
And where did they get those animals? Why did they have them?
They got them illegally from other breeders in the United States. As far as we know, our investigation never showed that any of them were illegally imported from other countries. But there's a thriving trade in this in the United States that is, if endangered species are being sold across state lines, are almost always going to be illegal. There are special permits that can be obtained from the Fish and Wildlife Service, but very few people have those. And the goal, you know, people who have permits have to show that their activities enhance the survival of the species in question. So it's not just a blanket authority to buy and sell a snow leopard. You have to show that your activities are actually contributing to the survival of snow leopards in the wild. But again, there's a lot of money to be made. You know, every time you see a commercial or you go to a shopping mall or a car dealership or a county fair anywhere in the United States and you see tiger cubs, you know, come on in and have your picture taken, you know, for a mere $25 with this holding this tiger cub, odds are that tiger is in the trade illegally. Reputable facilities like AZA-accredited zoos do not allow that to happen to their tigers. Their tiger cubs are well taken care of. They are generally on public display, yes, but they're well taken care of. They are not in the animal trade. And the idea is that that certain zoos are holding these unique individuals for the purpose of someday contributing to breeding programs that would release them back into the wild. These private backyard breeders, they're not engaged in anything like that. They're engaged in profiteering. And we have records of some people who will allow hundreds of people to come in over the course of a weekend and handle seven-day-old tiger cubs. There's a risk to the tiger. There are tiger cubs that have died from this kind of activity. It's hot. They're being handled too much. They're perhaps becoming dehydrated and you know, they're just not. I mean, would you hand your seven-day-old infant to 500 people in a weekend?
No. Not when you put it that way. No, that's a good point.
Right. But tiger cubs, bear cubs, are just as delicate. And so there's a high mortality. Odds are that many of these tigers are in the trade illegally. And it's underground, so it's hard to detect. It's not like we get flyers in the mail saying, hey, there's going to be a tiger cub at this car dealership opening in Florida.
So how did you detect?
We don't know that.
How did you know about this case? How did you come upon that?
Actually, a tiger on the facility attacked a child, and the parents of the child eventually contacted the Fish and Wildlife Service. We started an investigation and were able to determine that the husband and wife team were regularly buying and selling live endangered species in interstate commerce. And we built a case against them, and they both went to prison over it. They're both convicted felons.
And did the facility close down?
Yes.
Have there been other cases? Can you tell me about the case of traditional medicine?
Sure. I recently, about a year ago, had a case sentenced. So it's finished in federal court, but the investigation goes back to about 2005. A mother-daughter smuggling team, wildlife and drug smuggling team, were living in the Twin Cities. Both had been born in Laos. The mother and daughter both had been born in Laos and then emigrated to the United States in the 80s. And the mother would go back to Laos, where she would obtain parts and pieces of different kinds of wildlife, much of it, the bulk of it, endangered, threatened, or protected by CITES, this international treaty. And she smuggled it back to the United States, where she sold it at a flea market in St. Paul. And we caught her as she came through the Minneapolis-St. Paul airport, and Customs actually found her, Customs and Agriculture found her, during what is called a secondary inspection. So anyone who's traveled internationally, odds are if you haven't had a secondary inspection yourself, you've seen someone else go through it. They pull you aside, they open up your suitcases and check, physically check to see what you're bringing back into the United States as compared with what it says on your customs declaration.
And what about her triggered that?
She had a bunch of plant material, and so she was actually sent to agriculture so that agriculture could look at the agriculture inspectors, I should say, so that they could look at the plant material that she was bringing back to see if it contained any pests, were there any seeds, agricultural pests or diseases, that sort of thing. There's sometimes people will bring citrus products back from Southeast Asia, and they can have citrus funguses and cankers and stuff that can spread to the citrus crops here in the United States and cause huge amounts of damage. So that's one of the things that agriculture checks for. Well, they took out one of the bundles of plant material and found wildlife, bones, pieces, and called our wildlife inspector at that airport, Linda Benson. Her supervisor also happened to be there that day, and they started going through the bags, and they found almost 1,400 pieces of individual wildlife, all kinds of species, elephant, Duke langur, which is a primate, slow loris, which is also a primate, porcupine quills. What else was there from that shipment? There were just strips of hide that were animal. It was animal hide, but we had no idea what it might be. And so they seized everything, contacted me. I went over there. We looked at it. We got some preliminary identifications. Linda Benson found out through the woman's son that she was selling it at a flea market, got the location of the flea market, and I went there a few days later and saw that much of the wildlife that was seized from this woman 3 days prior was still for sale in her shop. And so we started a criminal investigation into this woman, and at the time we didn't know anything about the daughter. As the investigation progressed, we found that the daughter was involved, the adult daughter was involved. They were also, by the way, the woman had also smuggled steroids back into the United States. She had a fabric belt that was sewn from traditional cloth, and on the inside of the belt, the part that would be facing the skin, there were 141 little pockets sewn, and each of those pockets contained a vial of anabolic steroid.
Really?
And yes. And this was at the airport, and so the sash was then wrapped up in a ball, hiding the vials on the inside. It was stuffed in a wooden canister, and then it was buried in one of the suitcases. And that was not declared. None of the wildlife was declared. None of the drugs were declared. And that's what led to the overall investigation of this woman and her daughter and their business. And we made a couple of undercover buys, sent the materials to the lab, confirmed that it was things like sero, which is a wild animal. It's about the size of a goat, but it has antelope-like horns. And that's CITES Appendix 1, and also endangered. Appendix 1 is the highest level of protection in it. You cannot commercialize Appendix 1 species. Leaf monkey, giant squirrels. Eventually, we found a clouded leopard bone, remains of a clouded leopard that she was selling. These salamanders that had only been discovered to exist in the world in 2002, and prior to this existence, scientists did not know that Laos even had salamanders. And this woman had 120 of them. We seized 120 of them from her during the course of the investigation. Tapir, which is another Appendix 1 animal that sort of has a pig-like hoof, except it's got three toes where pigs only have two. Just tons and tons of really endangered, protected stuff that she had been smuggling into the United States.
And what did she use it for?
Medicine. Some of the things that we learned during the course of the investigation, she had a bunch of, everybody knows what a mole is. It's a little small rodent-like creature. And she was bringing back Asian moles is their name. They were just, they're not endangered or anything like that, but they were terribly dried and desiccated. I mean, there was no fluid at all left in these things. They were crumbly. And one of the things we learned about the use of that is that when a woman goes into labor, you cook these moles in water, and the pregnant woman drinks the water, and that is supposed to help with labor. And I'm not sure if it's supposed to speed labor or if it's supposed to ease labor pains, but this is very popular medicine in this community, in this Laotian refugee community in the Twin Cities. It was very well known that this is, you know, the Asian moles help with labor. Some of the other things we learned, we were finding these strips of dried elephant hide. You could see the skin on the outside and the layers of the dermis underneath, and they were also very dry. You could see the hairs. The elephants have black, bristly hairs that are very wiry, and they were still sticking out of the skin side. And one of the things we learned is that you can cut pieces of the elephant, of this dried elephant meat, or grate it, like with a cheese grater, and cook it in water, and then wash a person who's had a stroke with this water, and that's supposed to help a person recover from a stroke.
Really?
Yes. Obviously have no evidence that this works, but for the Fish and Wildlife Service, The investigation was never about whether these remedies work or don't work. The investigation was always about, these are endangered animals. Are they coming into the country legally, and what's happening to them afterwards? And we discovered that they were being smuggled in, that they were being commercialized. And in the end, you know, when we counted up all the parts and pieces, one of the things I asked the lab to do was to try and tell me the number of separate individuals. The court wanted to know how many individual animals did this represent. And based on the different times when the animals were imported and also just the sheer numbers of things that we had, we were able to determine that with the Cerro, for example, she had enough horns and skull plates to account for 17 different individual Cerro animals. You know, the lab can tell this is a right horn, this is a left horn, and that sort of thing. And so we asked them to do that. Now, the actual number could have represented far more than 17, but the court wanted to know the base bottom line number of animals of each species that we could document for certain. And we came up with 3 Asian elephants based on the different times when she imported the elephant parts. It's very unlikely that you would import elephant parts from the same elephant on 3 different occasions. So, you know, like I said, 120 dried, desiccated salamander bodies. I think it was 120 also on the Asian moles. You know, 1 clouded leopard was all we could ever establish. 1 Asian golden cat. I think 2 leopard cats, the numbers are. But, you know, so that's one of the things that I asked our lab to do, our forensic lab to do, was to help me determine a bottom line number for the court, knowing that, you know, we would have to explain to the court that these numbers could actually represent a far larger number of animals.
And that's just one person, or her and her daughter.
Right. Right.
That has so many.
Amazing. And we found more steroids too.
Oh, really?
She was just selling over the counter. Yeah. She was selling them at her booth over the counter with a price tag on them. No prescription, no. You know, part of the danger, too, of this, of people who do things like this is you go into this booth and you tell someone your symptoms, they diagnose you with a disease and prescribe a treatment with no medical degree. I mean, that's how it works in this country, is you need to be a doctor in order to diagnose ailments and prescribe medication. And one of the hazards when you're selling steroids, anabolic steroids, over the counter, who's regulating that? Nobody. Are they being taken medicinally? Are they being taken by kids who want to bulk up? I mean, who knows? No one's. She wasn't keeping any records of that sort of thing. So.
And then what happened? What happened to her after the case?
Both her and her daughter were indicted on felony charges, felony smuggling charges. They were both convicted. The daughter paid a fine. It's a little bit of a sentencing is not necessarily a straightforward thing. Judges take all sorts of things into account, including the risk that a person will reoffend. And in the case of the daughter, who was in her 30s, the daughter had a job at a major U.S. company. She had children in the school system. She was married. The risk that she would reoffend, based on her background and based on her cooperation with the investigation as well, was very low. So she paid a fine, but she didn't go to jail. The mother continued to offend even after she knew she was under investigation. She continued to have endangered species illegally imported to her and sell them at the flea market even after she knew she was under investigation. After we served a search warrant on her booth, for example, she switched booths and continued to have wildlife sent to her.
Really?
She was selling at the booth. Yeah. Yeah. Including more salamanders and tapir parts and perhaps some other things that we never caught. So she was penalized more harshly. This is a woman who on paper was 86 years old and she was sentenced to 6 months in a halfway house, which is very unusual. Think about what it would take for a judge to send someone who is 86 years old and doesn't speak English away from their family to a halfway house, which is a form of incarceration. I mean, it's not federal prison, but you're not free to come and go as you will. All your activities are monitored. You know, she was separated from her family. She didn't have the financial ability to pay a fine, so she wasn't fined. But she had all sorts of, the judge imposed all sorts of restrictions on her as part of her sentence. For example, the judge gave us the authority to search her domestic mail packages over a certain weight without a search warrant. That's very unusual. Normally, if police want to know what's inside a package that's in domestic mail, they have to go get a search warrant and have to tell a judge, here's what we think is in the package and here's why we think it. Well, because this woman had so much illegal wildlife mailed to her, the judge said, nope, if it meets certain criteria, you don't need a warrant. Just go ahead and open it to see if it contains wildlife, because this is part of her pattern and she's going to reoffend. There's a high risk that she'll reoffend. So we got that. The woman was also sentenced to, part of her sentence is she had to help us make educational materials. And we worked on that with her. She also did the 6 months in a halfway house, and there's something else that I'm forgetting. Oh, she was prohibited from owning, sponsoring, working at any kind of booth, any kind of flea market, no matter what they were selling. She was prohibited from, you know, selling any kind of merchandise whatsoever in a flea market or booth type setting, including things where, you know, you might see a food stand at an athletic event, like a soccer match at a local field. She couldn't set up a booth there and sell food even. So those were some of the restrictions that she had in place. She is still on probation, which means that her activities are still monitored by a probation officer who's an officer of the court and a federal law enforcement officer. She can't leave the state, for example, without getting permission from her probation officer. You know, we still have the ability to search her packages, that sort of thing, until she's off probation. It's a way of follow-up, if you will, with convicted criminals to make sure that they don't go back to their old life of crime.
Well, I really appreciate your taking the time to talk with me.
Sure. I appreciate your interest in our agency.
I hope you enjoyed that conversation about the wildlife law enforcement adventures of U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service Special Agent Sheila O'Connor. Edited transcripts of selected programs are available on my website, laurelnemi.com, and also on mongabay.com. That's mongabay.com. You can also find archived episodes of The Wildlife on iTunes at my website, laurelnemi.com, and at laurelnemi.podbean.com. You can stream The Wildlife live at theradiator.org every Monday from 1 to 2 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. And, of course, if you have comments about this show or ideas for future ones, you can email me at laurel@laurelnemi.com. The Wildlife is generously underwritten by the Lake Champlain Land Trust, a nonprofit organization permanently conserving the lands, lakeshore, critical wildlife habitats, and natural areas of Lake Champlain. More information is available online at lclt.org. This has been The Wildlife. I'm your host, Laurel Nemi, and you're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMM LP, in Burlington, Vermont.